Thank you all for coming to this session. Welcome. My name is Maggie Grabo, and I'd like to acknowledge the second author on this work, Scott Spack, as well as my faculty advisor, Jonathan Patz. And I have no relationships to disclose today. I'll begin today by stating a fact that I'm sure many of you already know, that the United States is a huge contributor of carbon dioxide. One-third of these emissions come from the transportation sector alone. And tailpipe emissions are only a part of the motor vehicle's contribution to climate change. Over the vehicle's life cycle, emissions are generated during extraction of raw materials and movement, production, and disposal. These emissions are estimated to add 18 to 43% to tailpipe emissions. We know that greenhouse gas emissions substantially contribute to climate change. And we know the implications of climate change are huge, especially when it comes to human health. As you can see here, health effects from climate change range from heat stress to vector-borne disease to malnutrition. Many people, therefore, are considering how can we reduce these CO2 emissions? And this is not just about protecting the environment, but also about improving human health. We can show that action on climate change provides co-benefits to health. In fact, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change concludes that the costs of climate change mitigation would largely be compensated by health gains from reduced air pollution alone. And the benefits would be wider. Consider the fastest growing section, transportation. Urban planning that provides safe opportunities to walk and cycle and use mass transit could also help address some of the other largest public health burdens today. The information in this graph represents a lot of the impetus behind the study at hand. This is a CDC graph of the 10 leading causes of death in the United States in 2004. You'll notice here that the six out of the top 10 leading causes of death per year could be attributable, for the most part, to adopting a more sedentary lifestyle and being exposed to additional air pollutant emissions. So what's the common link between these six leading causes of death? Perhaps our greater reliance on motor vehicles and our changing landscape. It certainly isn't news to all of you that 50% of Americans do not meet physical activity recommendations and that two-thirds of Americans are overweight or obese. We live in a society today where there is drive-through everything, and unfortunately, this has taken its toll on our waistlines and our pocketbooks. Over 100 U.S. cities are not meeting the EPA's National Ambient Air Quality Standards for ozone, and over 50 cities are not meeting the standards for fine particulate matter. And unfortunately, cars play a large role in this equation because they are substantial emitters of the fine particulate matter as well as the precursors to ozone, which are volatile organic compounds and nitrogen oxides. Did you know that 40% of all car trips in the United States are 2 miles or less? Did you know that 50% of the working population commutes 5 miles or less to work in the U.S.? And that more than 82% of trips 5 miles or less are made by personal motor vehicle? So I ask you this, is it necessary to rely on our cars so much? And would you consider these distances walkable or bikeable? So here's a summary of the facts. We all know that obesity is a problem of epidemic proportions. We know that physical inactivity is increasing. We know that cities are failing to meet our air quality standards and greenhouse gas emissions are rising. So what does this mean for our health and our economy? This is our opportunity to take advantage of the co-benefits of mitigating climate change and an opportunity for improving our health determinants. Now I present to you our project on biking for co-benefits, personal fitness and health, air quality and human health, greenhouse gas mitigation, and our economy. This project encompasses the 11 largest cities in the upper Midwest. Our objective is replacing short auto trips of about 2.5 miles or less with mass transit and active transport. This study affects people living in the most densely populated areas of the Midwest, where it makes sense to bicycle and walk. This slide shows our integrated modeling process. Our new approach unites state-of-the-art approaches to modeling transportation, emissions, air pollution, and the health effects of air pollution and active transport. Guess my mouse doesn't want to work here. Oh, there it is. Okay. First, we incorporate U.S. Census data and empirical relationships between land use, demographics, and travel for the Pluto portion of the project. Then, using the CMAQ, or Community Multiscale Air Quality Model, and the EPA Emissions Model Mobile 6, we model and map emission scenarios. And these first two components of the study I'm not going to focus on today, as second author Scott Speck is publishing these results in another paper. So thirdly, we use the EPA health effects tool called BEDMAP, which uses leading epidemiological studies to determine health incidence and valuation. Finally, we use the World Health Organization's tool called Heat for Cycling to determine the health and economic benefits of increased physical activity. So for the first part of the study, estimating the impacts of air pollution exposure, we consider the effects of substituting bike trips for all short trips in these Midwestern urban and suburban census tracts. Note that this is 50% of all car trips taken and 20% of all vehicle miles traveled during the warmest 6 months of the year in these densely populated areas of the upper Midwest. So we used the EPA's fantastic modeling software program called BENMAP, which stands for Benefits Mapping Analysis Program, to estimate the health and economic benefits of a reduction in fine particulates and ozone exposure. BENMAP uses a damage function approach to estimate the health impact and economic values associated with these changes in ambient air pollution. BENMAP uses the best health impact dose response functions from peer-reviewed studies that the EPA also uses for their regulatory analyses. For those of you visual learners out there, this slide gives you a more GIS-based spatial context of the benefits analysis that we used. You see here at the top, we have the change in ambient air concentrations layered on top of the census tract level population counts, and then utilizing the concentration response functions and baseline disease and mortality rate, we can determine a reduction in disease counts and deaths. So now onto our results for the air pollution portion. We saw a small reduction in fine particulates due to decreases in car trips in the 11 cities. However, despite the small reduction in fine particulates, we actually saw a huge health benefit. You can also notice from this map that the populations outside the cities also saw a reduced exposure to PM2.5 and the related health benefits. Here you can see the annual reduction in mortalities due to changes in fine particulates. These are the tiny particles that get lodged deep down in your lungs. Notice Chicago sees 162 fewer deaths, Detroit sees 106 fewer deaths, and Cleveland sees 53 fewer deaths due to reduced exposure to these fine particulates. And now for our results on ozone. We found that in large urban areas, there was actually an increase in 8-hour average ozone concentrations, yet the peak ozone actually decreased. But despite the fact that this average ozone did increase, we still saw health benefits. And additionally, as you can see on this map, we did notice that both peak and 8-hour ozone average concentrations decreased in outlying suburbs and small urban areas. And you'll have to note, I know this is puzzling, why did the ozone actually increase? But this has to do with the complex ozone chemistry. So in short, our BenMap results, we saw a decrease in annual average urban fine particulates by about 0.1 microgram per cubic meter, which seems like a small, minute amount, but we actually saw quite substantial health benefits. We saw a slight increase in summer ozone in the cities, but there was a decrease in the ozone regionally. We also saw big changes on the worst air pollution days. And in terms of mortalities, we saw 425 fewer annual deaths and a savings of $3.5 billion on an annual basis. Okay, now on to the second portion, the heat for cycling portion of the project. So we used the World Health Organization's Health Economic Assessment Tool for cycling to estimate the health and economic benefits of physical activity for bicycling. So we considered 50% of the short trips that we considered for the air pollution portion of the study, and we considered these trips during the warmest months of the year, where bicycling is more likely. And here's a taste of some of our heat results. So we found a reduction in approximately 700 deaths annually from increased physical activity. For instance, we saw 278 fewer deaths in the Twin Cities area and 219 fewer deaths in Chicago. And we also saw an even greater savings of $3.8 billion on an annual basis from reduced mortality. And you'll notice that there was more savings in the from the suburban trips at $2.5 billion and $1.25 billion for the urban trips. Of course, an added benefit of removing 20% of VMT from the region is also reduced emissions of greenhouse gases that cause global climate change. The annual reduction would be about 4 trillion fewer pounds of CO2, which is 1.8 teragrams. And for those of you who need a reference, like I did, this is equal to the takeoff weight of over 4 million Boeing 747 aircrafts. Okay. So what does all this mean? From both projects looking at air pollution and physical activity, we see mortality declines by 1,100 deaths annually. The combined regional benefits exceed $7 billion annually in the Midwest alone. Health improvements were found in downwind rural areas, not just in the urban areas that we focused on in the study. And though we saw small changes in air quality, we actually found huge health benefits for those living in these densely populated areas. So you ask, well, what about injury? Is it really safe to be bicycling more in these cities? Well, one recent Dutch study proved the benefit from physical activity actually outweighs the risk from both traffic-related fatality and increased pollution inhalation. So there really are some potential gains from incorporating bicycling and walking into one's daily routine. So as a result of changing urban travel behavior, we see the co-benefits of mitigating climate change. We can achieve sustainable health through taking care of our current populations without compromising the opportunity for health of further generations. Transportation policy has enormous potential to catalyze the development of healthy communities, but it requires an initial investment and a long-term commitment. Now, this is not a huge paradigm shift. Instead, we are promoting bicycling and walking as a cost-effective investment with tremendous multiple returns. We now have better ways of understanding how changes in people's behavior can affect our world and thus make better-formed urban policy decisions. In our analysis in the U.S. Census, there is an ongoing trend toward bicycling in these areas of the United States. So we have an opportunity to make informed urban policy choices and decisions to provide the appropriate bicycle and pedestrian infrastructure. Small choices can make our cities more sustainable in every way. It's a four-way win. If we can swap bikes for cars, we gain in fitness, local air quality, a reduction in greenhouse gases that affects global climate, and the personal, economic, and quality of life benefits of biking when it's faster and easier than driving. Plus, we all know that bicycling is fun. So with that, I'd like to thank you for your time, and I'd like to acknowledge all the folks that are on my team. Thank you.
Okay, we indirect or direct causes? I mean, was it mainly costs avoided by not having people dying, or was it actual costing?
So it's, yes, the costs of avoided mortality or avoided asthma exacerbations. Yes.
You were talking about the big health benefits. You were just talking about reducing mortality then, not having to do with other reductions in the diseases that you showed.
That's a great question. So the first air pollution portion is looking at other health morbidities. We're looking at asthma. We're looking at hospital admissions. We're looking at mortality. The physical activity portion is merely looking at reduced mortality from cardiovascular distress disease.
I also just have another. So the model that you use, the,
yes.
I forget what the acronym is, the CMAQ?
The CMAQ is the air quality, BenMap is the benefits mapping model that we used, yes.
The benefits mapping model is sort of a black box to me, but I assume you like factor in a bunch of things. You're not just sort of saying, we've reduced pollution, and so therefore we see this benefit. There's a lot of other things going on.
Yes, so you're asking about the BenMap model that we used, and it is kind of a black box. However, if you want to learn more about our methodology, actually this paper was published today in Environmental Health Perspectives on the Ahead of Print page, so you can see what our choices were for which epidemiologic studies, that dose response functions that we used, and we used the ones that the EPA uses on their regulatory analyses. So for further information on the kind of the background, you can check out our paper. Yes.
So you touched on the injury question.
Yes.
I'm glad you touched on. I understand that heat is going to be updated at some point in the near-ish future, hopefully, with that won't, so it will include an injury component as well. I don't have exactly a question, but really more of a challenge to us as public health professionals in kind of thinking about this issue holistically. I wonder if there's a way for us to not discount the important role that injury plays as a driver in people's decision about whether to undertake, you know, bicycling as an alternative, but rather to say, you know, this is an important issue that we need to address in order to get to the shared goal we have of promoting physical activity. I'd hate to see us just battling out which is the more important thing to address, basically. But rather say we need to work on injury and we need to work on getting people into active transportation.
Right.
Which I see us kind of going in that direction with some of these analyses.
Mm-hmm. It's troubling. Right, and I'm sure many of you have read the Jacobson study that says there's a threshold effect on bicycling. If there's 50 bicyclists in one place every hour, then there's the higher propensity for drivers to be more aware and to drive more safely. So it's getting to the point where bikers are more aware of drivers and drivers are more aware of bikers, and there's education, and so we can get to the point where we can coexist like they do in countries such as the Netherlands and Denmark.
Also, I might just add on to that also, but you did talk about the infrastructure for bicycling, and this issue of safety is a driver for money in transportation. And so, I mean, what struck me a little different from what struck you is you got to make the injury argument to get the money.
Right.
From the transportation sector, who has it, in order to make the improvements to make bicycling both attractive and also safer. So, mm-hmm. Maybe for different reason, I think you're right that
no,
must
okay.
be part of the discussion. But anyway, mm-hmm. that was an excellent presentation.
Okay,
thank you very much.
Thank you.
A lot of work. Thank you for that, huh?